First, then, what does St. Thomas mean by the term conscience, in Latin, conscientia? Some people have used this word to denote a special power of the soul whose province would be the making of moral judgments. However, Aquinas didn't believe in the existence of such a power, since our intellect is already a power made for apprehending truth. It follows that any kind of truth, whether moral or non-moral, can be an object for the intellect. Thus, it is our intellect, for example, that sees both that twice two is four and that lying is wrong. By conscience, St. Thomas means a certain class of judgments made by our intellect, namely the judgments we make about acts that we have done or are doing or are thinking of doing. By its etymology, he notes, conscientia suggests the application of knowledge to something, and we are said to make a judgment of conscience when we apply our knowledge to our own actions. He distinguishes three cases. Either we are simply aware of the fact of having done something, or else we judge about the goodness or evil of something which we have done, or we judge that a possible future act is something we should or should not or may do. And this explains, he says, the actions that are commonly attributed to conscience, for it is said to bear witness about the mere fact of some past action, to acquit, accuse, or even torment us about the goodness or evil of a past act, and to impel or restrain us about some future act. Conscience, then, is the judgment that an actual or potential action of mine is or was good or bad, obligatory, forbidden, or optional. Finally, he notes that while the word denotes, strictly speaking, these acts of judgment, it also, by a natural process, is used to denote one of the internal causes from which these acts spring, namely, our habitual tendency to recognize certain basic goods, such as life and existence in society, as goods which are naturally suited to us. So after that brief account of what St. Thomas means by the Latin word, conscientia, I come now to consider two ways in which his teaching about conscience may be distorted and is distorted by some people, and to show how serious these distortions are for the life of the church today. The first distortion of Aquinas' teaching is to say that he holds that my conscience is an authority in the sense of something that authorizes me to act. On this view, the mere fact that I judge that some possible action of mine would be good to perform gives to me the right to perform it and gives to other people the duty to allow me to do so. This distorted view was, I'm sorry to say, recently expressed in very strong terms by an American archbishop when speaking at a university in England. Referring to married couples and families, he declared, without qualification, their decisions of conscience represent God's personal guidance for the particularities of their lives. In the course of his talk, the same speaker explicitly identified the voice of conscience with the voice of God for each person. Other people, without going quite so far as this archbishop, will say that my judgment about the goodness of some future act gives me a right to perform it and gives to other people a duty to allow me to perform it, provided at least that any error I may make in my judgment is not the result of my own negligence in seeking the truth. Now, this common view that my simple judgment of conscience authorizes me to act in accordance with it and make such action good for me arises out of a misinterpretation of St. Thomas's dictum that an erring reason binds. To say, as St. Thomas does, that an erring reason binds means that if I mistakenly perceive some action as good and obligatory on me, then I commit a sin by failing to perform it. And likewise, if I mistakenly perceive some action as evil and forbidden, then I commit a sin if I do perform it. And that is St. Thomas's position. For example, if I suppose erroneously that blood transfusions are against the law of God, then I commit a sin if I choose to have a blood transfusion. St. Thomas puts it like this: since the object of the will is something which is proposed by the reason, therefore, from the very fact that a thing is proposed by the reason as evil, the will, by tending toward it, becomes evil. In other words, if I choose that which I believe to be evil, even if it is in fact good, then insofar as in me lies, I am consenting to evil, and hence committing a sin. And the same applies to omissions. For example, if I erroneously suppose that it is obligatory on me to go on pilgrimage to Mecca, then if I choose not to go to Mecca in order to save money, then I am committing a sin, since I am deliberately refusing what appears to me, erroneously, as an obligatory good action. However, and this is where people's confusion enters in, the fact that I commit a sin by acting contrary to my judgment about good and evil does not imply that I act well by following my judgment about good and evil. Nor does it imply that anybody else has the duty to allow me to follow it. For example, if I suppose erroneously that blood transfusions are against the law of God, and so I am ready to allow a child under my care to bleed to death, then I do not act virtuously. And the civil authority, by contrast, acts well by giving the child a blood transfusion against my will. My conscientious objection to blood transfusion, even if very intense, even if I'm ready to go to prison to maintain it, does not make it virtuous or even morally permissible for me to refuse a transfusion for myself or for anyone else. Thus, for St. Thomas, The fact that my will is in conformity with my conscience, though a necessary condition for my action to be good, is not a sufficient condition. My judgment of conscience must also be true. Two things, then, are necessary for an action of mine to be good. I must make a correct judgment of conscience, and I must act in accordance with it. The mere fact that an action is in accordance with my conscience does not of itself authorize me to perform it. And this is what I meant by denying that for St. Thomas, conscience is of itself an authority. What has authority are God and the good, and conscience only has authority to the extent that it adheres to God and to the good, that is to say, insofar as it judges rightly. So this is the first of the two distortions of Aquinas' teaching that I wished to mention. This idea that following one's conscience by itself is sufficient to make an action good or permissible. And it is not difficult to see how devastating this distortion is for all authority, both civil and ecclesiastical. If an action were good from the mere fact of being in conformity with conscience, with no requirement that my judgment of conscience also be true, then what right would civil or ecclesiastical authority have to prohibit any kind of evil or harmful deed, provided that those perpetrating them claimed to be acting in conscience? The suicide bomber who conscientiously carried out his mission would then be performing a good action. And what right has anyone to hinder another's good deed? Or within the church, if someone were to feel bound in conscience to live in an adulterous or unnatural union, then the pastors would have to allow him, and indeed to praise him for doing so. The second distortion of St. Thomas's teaching lies in a misuse of something else which he says about the mistaken conscience. As we have just seen, he holds that no will which accords with a false judgment of conscience can be good. Nevertheless, he also holds that there are circumstances in which such a will may not be bad. It depends on what causes the person to be mistaken in the first place, and in particular on whether his ignorance is voluntary. For example, let us suppose that some bottle of medicine has been erroneously labeled by the manufacturer. The chemist who sells it therefore supposes that it contains drugs that will cure a certain patient, when in fact it contains drugs that will kill him. The chemist thus makes the erroneous judgment of conscience: it would be good to give this bottle to this patient, and he acts accordingly. St. Thomas would say that the choice to give the bottle and the giving of it are not good, yet neither are they bad. They are the result of an ignorance which was not in any way voluntary on the part of the chemist, and so they are not imputable to him either as good or as bad. Thus, it is possible on St. Thomas's principles erroneously to suppose a certain action to be good in this case, giving to someone drugs that will kill him, and yet to perform this action without committing a sin. On the other hand, if the chemists had known that the manufacturers had labeled bottles incorrectly in the past, and he did not attempt to verify the contents of the new bottle, then he might well be guilty of negligence. And in that case, neither his ignorance about the contents of the bottle nor his decision to hand it over would be free from fault. In general, Aquinas says, where the ignorance at the root of a faulty conscience derives either from negligence in seeking the truth, or even from a conscious decision not to seek it, then such ignorance is voluntary, and actions deriving from it are morally imputable to the agent. Where, by contrast, the ignorance is involuntary, it is inculpable, and the actions that derive from it are not morally imputable to the agent, either as good or bad. Now, some authors have suggested that inculpable ignorance can extend not only to the knowledge of individual facts, for example, about whether a bottle is correctly labeled, but also to the divine commandments themselves. For example, they argue that somebody may judge erroneously, but inculpably, that adultery is not an intrinsic evil. Such a person, reflecting on some possible future act of adultery, may thus make the erroneous judgment, "This action is permitted to me." And although, as these authors say, any resulting act of adultery would not be good, yet neither, they argue, would it be imputable to the agent as bad, since his decision that the act was permissible resulted from, supposedly, his invincible ignorance about the intrinsic evil of adultery. And it might therefore even be possible that he would remain in a state of grace while committing adultery. So for the rest of this talk, I'd like to examine this view that it is possible, in virtue of an invincibly ignorant conscience, to violate the divine commandments while remaining in a state of grace. And I'm going to consider four slightly different versions of this claim, which are being put forward today by certain prelates and theologians, and to see how St. Thomas would have responded to them. And to avoid certain complications that would otherwise arise, and in order to respond more closely to today's ecclesial situation, I shall consider only the case of Catholics who violate divine commandments that forbid intrinsically evil acts, such as the divine commandment against adultery. So the hypothesis that we're considering appears to me to be put forward today in one simple form and in three slightly more developed forms. So I shall first summarize these and then consider each one in turn. So the simple form of the hypothesis claims that Catholics, while being in a state of grace, may be simply and inculpably ignorant of a divine commandment. For example, they may be ignorant that God has forbidden fornication, and hence may commit this sin while remaining in a state of sanctifying grace. Thus, a recent article in the worthy French theological journal Revue Thomiste suggests that Catholics today who cohabit outside of marriage may be free of the guilt of mortal sin because their lack of religious instruction and the general corruption of the culture makes them unaware of the seriousness of their actions. The second version of the hypothesis is simply a more extreme version of the first. This claims that Catholics, while being in a state of grace, can be ignorant that something is contrary to the law of God, even though they know that the Church teaches that it is thus contrary. For example, they may know that the Church teaches that adultery is contrary to the law of God, but they may be blamelessly unable, or at least unable without serious blame, to accept the truth of this teaching. They have difficulty in grasping the value of the rule, and hence they may commit adultery while remaining in a state of grace. The third version of our hypothesis claims that Catholics, while being in a state of grace, can know, accept that something is forbidden by the law of God, but they can be ignorant that this law is seriously binding upon them. Rather than binding only under pain of venial sin. Or else they can think of the law as being only a kind of ideal or counsel of perfection. For example, they may know, or they may say, that adultery is contrary to the law of God, but they may nonetheless be ignorantly, invincibly ignorant that they are seriously obliged to avoid it, and hence they may commit this sin while remaining in God's grace. And the fourth and final version of our hypothesis claims that Catholics may know that a divine commandment is seriously binding, yet may be free of the guilt of mortal sin if they break it, because the only alternatives seem to them to involve committing a worse sin. For example, a Catholic may know that adultery is contrary to the law of God, and know this law is seriously binding, and yet may commit adultery while remaining in a state of grace, because he supposes that his only alternative course is to do something contrary to an even more important divine command. So, having set out the four versions of this hypothesis, I'd like to see now how I think St. Thomas would respond to them. So the first claim was that Catholics in a state of grace may be simply ignorant of a divine commandment. They simply don't know that God has ever forbidden this particular sin, and so they may remain in a state of grace while breaking it. So as we've seen in slightly earlier in this talk, the general principle that St. Thomas puts forward about the effect of ignorance on the goodness or badness of one's actions is that the voluntariness or the involuntariness of the ignorance causes the act that is performed in virtue of the ignorance to be itself either voluntary or involuntary, and hence causes this act to be either imputable to the agent or not. So the question then is whether it is possible for a Catholic to be involuntarily ignorant of a divine commandment about intrinsically evil actions. Because if he could be involuntarily ignorant, then it would follow on St. Thomas's principles that he would not be guilty of a sin in breaking it. Now, so far from allowing this possibility to Catholics, St. Thomas excludes it from mankind in general. In the Summa Theologiae, question 88, article 6 of the Prima Secundae, he asks whether a sin which is by nature mortal can become venial owing to some circumstance. He's going to argue that it can't, but first he imagines an objector putting to him the following case. It may happen, the objector says, that a person in committing a sin which is of a mortal kind loves a creature less than God. For instance, if someone who is ignorant that simple fornication is a mortal sin contrary to the love of God commits the sin of fornication, yet so as to be ready for the love of God to refrain from that sin if he knew that by committing it he was acting counter to the love of God. Therefore, the objector concludes, his will be a venial sin, and accordingly a mortal sin can become venial. So the idea is that this person, if he knew that what he was doing was seriously wrong, would stop doing it. But St. Thomas replies that in this case, the person committing the act of fornication would still be guilty of a mortal sin because he had been gravely negligent in ascertaining what the law of God is. He writes, "The ignorance itself is a sin and contains within itself a lack of the love of God, insofar as the man neglects to learn those things whereby he can safeguard himself in the love of God." And it's noteworthy that Aquinas gives the example of fornication because he was aware that pagans in general, unlike the Jews, had not considered this to be a grave matter. And yet he does not think that a person who acts in accordance with this error is free from the guilt of mortal sin. And so, although the article from the Revue Thomiste that I quoted is correct to say that the pagan atmosphere of the modern world makes it more likely that Catholics will indeed be ignorant of the divine laws that govern, for example, sexual behavior, St. Thomas holds that this ignorance itself is still gravely sinful. It contains within itself, he says, a lack of the love of God, since it means that a person has neglected to learn how to please him. And so while the bad example of the surrounding culture can certainly lessen the guilt of such ignorance, it cannot, according to St. Thomas, convert it from mortal to venial. Similarly, and naturally, given that adultery is a graver sin than fornication, Aquinas rejects the idea that ignorance of the divine law against adultery could ever be involuntary. So he writes, if an erring reason tells a man that he should go to another man's wife, the will that abides by this erring reason is evil, since this error arises from ignorance of the divine law, which he is obliged to know. And that's in the Prima Secundae, question 19, article 6. And we see here, it seems to me, a certain danger in the maxim often repeated today that full knowledge and consent are necessary conditions for mortal sin. It is not, in fact, necessary to know that something is a mortal sin in order to incur the guilt of mortal sin by committing it. St. Thomas's consistent position is that the only kind of lack of awareness of God's commandments which can excuse someone who breaks them from mortal sin is a lack of awareness which is due to madness or mental disability, things which, in his opinion, excuse even from venial sin. It is interesting to note that the modern catechism of the Catholic Church, although it uses the maxim about full knowledge and consent as necessary for mortal sin, goes on immediately to add that feigned ignorance and hardness of heart do not excuse one, and also that no one is deemed to be ignorant of the principles of the moral law. Given these large qualifications, and given the importance of the question at stake, I wonder if it is wise to continue to use this maxim in preaching and catechesis, at least without a lot of explanation. But that would take us too far. The second, then, of the four hypotheses that I distinguished was that Catholics, while living in grace, can be ignorant that something is contrary to the law of God, even though they know that the Church teaches that it is. They inculpably fail to see the value of the rule. I don't want to spend long on this hypothesis, since it is excluded by the same arguments that excluded the first one. If men, in general, are guilty for their ignorance when they do not know that certain acts are intrinsically evil, then clearly catechized Catholics are as well. In fact, St. Thomas would hold that Catholics who know the Church's teaching but do not adhere to it are guilty not only of a culpable lack of knowledge of the truth, but also of the gravest sin of heresy. It is manifest, he says, that he who adheres to the teaching of the Church as to an infallible rule assents to whatever the Church teaches. Otherwise, if of the things taught by the Church he holds what he chooses to hold and rejects what he chooses to reject, he no longer adheres to the teaching of the Church as to an infallible rule, but to his own will. And for a baptized person to place his own will on the same level as or even above the infallible teaching of the Church is the very definition of heresy. So a Catholic who refused to accept the Church's infallible teaching about the divine law would therefore, by that fact, be unable to possess the virtue of faith, and so could not be living in a state of grace, since faith is the principle and foundation of the whole supernatural life. The third version of our hypothesis suggests that Catholics in a state of grace who know that something, or who say that they know that something is forbidden by the law of God, could be ignorant that this law binds them gravely, They could suppose that it binds them only under pain of venial sin, or even that, like the rules and not the vows of religious orders, it does not bind under pain of sin at all, but rather simply presents them with a kind of ideal at which to aim. Aquinas, I think, would say that this suggestion simply misunderstands what it means to know, as we are obliged under pain of gravely sinful negligence to know, that something belongs to divine law. To know that something belongs to divine law just is to know that there is a divine commandment about it, and that anyone who breaks this commandment sins mortally by preferring some created thing to God. Hence, in the De Veritate, he writes that the very fact that someone has the will not to observe anything which he believes, rightly or wrongly, to be contained in the law of God means that that person sins mortally. In other words, part of knowing that something is in the divine law, as we must know, is knowing that it binds us gravely. And so somebody who thinks what he may still call divine law is in fact only a kind of ideal, is therefore in fact in the position considered in the first hypothesis, that is, such a person is just ignorant of a divine law about intrinsically evil acts. And the fourth and last hypothesis that I mentioned was that a Catholic, while being in a state of grace, may know that a divine commandment is seriously binding on him, but may be free of the guilt of mortal sin if he breaks it, because the only alternative course seems to him to involve a worse sin. So this was a question that was already classic in the 13th century. And technically, such a person who is so situated that he will sin whatever he does, is said to be perplexus, perplexed. And St. Thomas's consistent teaching here is that no one need remain in such a state, since it is caused only by some underlying bad choice which can always be revoked. So he gives the example of someone who likes to do what is right in order to be praised by others. Such a person is perplexed for the moment, in the sense that whether he does the right thing in order to be praised or whether he omits to do it, he will be guilty either of a sin of vainglory or of a sin of omission. Yet such a person need not remain perplexed, since he can always set aside his underlying intention of acquiring human praise and then do the right thing for the right reason. We may also express St. Thomas's meaning in a more general way, to show why no one is obliged to remain perplexed. Since good and evil are contraries, if it would be evil to perform some action, it cannot also be evil to omit to perform the same action in the same circumstances. Or again, if it would be evil to omit to perform it, it cannot also be evil to perform this action in the same circumstances. Hence, if someone is really perplexed, it is only because he intends to order some good action to an evil end, as with the person who intends to order his good actions to the evil end, which is vainglory. Hence, as St. Thomas says, a perplexed man has some bad underlying intention that he can and should revoke. Now, it is possible that someone should have falsified his conscience, and so, as a result, might wrongly think that he is obliged to choose between two evil actions. We could take the example of a soldier who has been taught that he must obey all orders unquestioningly, whatever they are, and who is ordered to kill an innocent person, and who knows that this is wrong. As this person's conscience stands, and he has culpably falsified his conscience by accepting the teaching that he must obey all orders, whatever they are, as this person's conscience stands, he will sin whatever he does. The person in such a position, therefore, must pray for light from God, and if he prays earnestly, he will be given it. For if he chooses something, believing it to be gravely evil, even if he believes that the alternative would be worse, then he is consenting to mortal sin. More generally, we can say that it is impossible for a person so to entangle his life that there is no longer any good course available to him, and so that he must break God's law in one way or another. To claim that this is possible is to say that God's law sometimes makes incompatible demands on us, which would be to blaspheme against the divine wisdom. And to conclude, as various authors have noted, St. Thomas's moral teaching is not a morality of conscience in the sense that he does not hold that good action simply means action in conformity with conscience. Good action, rather, means action that attains God and the good, with our correct judgment of conscience being simply a necessary condition for this to happen. Far from being always the voice of God, conscience can be the voice of the flesh or even of the devil. While it is possible for men to be ignorant of the divine law and the intrinsic evil of certain kinds of action, such ignorance does not excuse them from mortal sin, since even where bad education or a corrupt ambient culture exists as mitigating factors, their very ignorance is itself still a mortal sin. A negligence, St. Thomas says, to learn the things whereby we can safeguard in ourselves the love of God. And in saying this, the angelic doctor is simply being true to the teaching of the New Testament. Writing to the Ephesians, St. Paul does not say that the ignorance of the divine law under which the Gentiles labored excused them from guilt, but rather that it separated them from God. They are, he says, alienated from the life of God through the ignorance that is in them. And the apostle of divine love, St. John, assures us in his first epistle that it is not possible to combine the state of grace and intrinsically evil actions. Little children, he says, let no one deceive you. He that doth justice is just. Whosoever is born of God committeth not sin, for God's seed abideth in him, and he cannot sin because he is born of God. Thank you for your attention.